That Dark Spring, A True Story of Death and Desire in 1920s Provence, by Susanna Stapleton, read by Natalie Buscombe, including an introductory note read by the author. To begin at the beginning. A note from the author. This is a work of non-fiction. As far as any account of a lost world can be, it is completely and provably true. All details, large or small, have been taken from the thousands of historical documents collected while researching the exuberant life and curious death of Olive Branson. These include personal diaries, letters and memoirs, police and judicial files, civic records, newspaper accounts, meteorological reports, photographs and artworks. Dialogue has been reconstructed from official documents and press reports. On occasion, the word perhaps or similar has been used. These perhapses are based on known and reoccurring events or actions that are more likely than not to have been repeated at the time in question. With that in mind, I invite you to settle back and join me in the wilds of interwar Provence for a tale that remains as perplexing today as it was in 1929. Susanna Stapleton. It is not that Les Baux invites or embraces the stranger. It rather dares you to live there. It is France's haunted bedchamber, not only full of ghosts, but a ghost itself. Edith Shackleton Heald, 1929. La pierre tombe, l'âme reste. The stone falls, the soul remains. Paul Manivet, Provençal poet. Part 1. The Ghosts of Les Baux. Chapter 1. Les Baux de Provence, France. Evening, Saturday the 27th of April, 1929. The Anglaise was dead. It was inconvenient timing, but the villagers kept watch over her body, as they would keep watch over any of their dead. At least, they tried. The first convention to fall by the wayside was that which confined the deceased to his or her own bed until the day of the funeral. As the Anglaise had not died in her own bed, and her farmhouse had been sealed by the authorities, that had not been possible. Instead, they had brought her up to the village on a handcart, intending to lay her out in the little-used mortuary by the cemetery. Just as they were trundling the body along the ramparts, however, having struggled up through the Porte des Guerres, young François Pinet called them back and offered a room in the Hôtel Monte Carlo. The small, family-run hotel was perched at the very edge of the medieval citadel. It had formed the centre of village life for as long as anyone could remember, its café and terrace providing the backdrop to endless trivial dramas, and the Grande Salle hosting feasts for every conceivable occasion. That it still did was thanks to the Anglaise herself, whose recent purchase and renovation of the buildings had saved it from being absorbed by the altogether more refined Hôtel Reine Jeanne next door. The bedroom in which they laid out her body held testament to the effort she had expended to rescue the hotel. The fact that the roof was not about to cave in was due to the architect she had engaged to sort out the sagging beams, while the fresh whitewash on the walls was there at her insistence, along with the cheerful blue on the shutters that had been pulled across the window outside. She'd even clambered up a ladder to paint the picture rails herself, in the same manner as she had attacked all the others in the hotel, which is to say, somewhat testily, after dismissing the miserable Isnard, who had downed tools on the grounds that picture rails had not been specified in his contract. No doubt her death had occasioned a few additional details to the room. A chair or two placed near the bed for the watchers, some black crepe to cover the mirror, perhaps even a pious cluster of candles. But how far did they take tradition? Did they trouble to leave the window ajar, even though thunderstorms were rumbling across the plain, and there had been opportunity aplenty for her soul to escape in the hours since her body had been pulled from the water? Did they maintain a respectful silence, despite all there was to discuss? It wasn't as though the Anglaise had found